Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry Bahamas.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. A slightly different episode to usual. Ben and I have just landed in Barbados, so just the two of us for the majority of this episode. We'll be reacting to England's draw in Antigua, a fantastic start to the Women's World Cup, India-Sri Lanka, some changes to the MCC laws and more. We'll briefly be joined by Taha over Zoom from Pakistan to look back at the first test between Pakistan and Australia at Rawalpindi. Hopefully the background noise gives you a sense of the atmosphere on the island at the moment. Forgive us if we're a bit slow on this episode. It's been a really long day. Let's start with the test in Antigua. Ben, from an English point of view, some calm after the storm that was a disastrous Ashes series early in the winter. It's the first time since 2016 that England have had three centurions in the same test. The first time since 2018 that England have scored 300 in both innings of a test. They weren't that close to winning in the end, but after finding themselves 48-4 in the first morning, that was a fairly encouraging few days in the end.
Yeah, this isn't exactly Operation Red Bull Reset after a rip-roaring start.
It's not quite England, New Zealand, the white ball stuff in 2015.
No, it isn't. But more, I think maybe Agnew said more positives than negatives, which I think is a fair way to put it. I think the biggest positive for me is that best 100 on day one. I was almost tempted to say it was more encouraging than his Australia 100. I don't think that's quite the case. I think you've got to think back to before that 100, there were doubts over whether Bairstow could be a legitimate force as a test batter kind of at any point again. That dispelled that. But this was, it was classic Bairstow, sort of like counter-punching, like a bit angry at the end. He got annoyed at someone in the crowd. I mean, fair enough, that's what he does. This was just a very normal test 100 in a way, albeit it came when England were 40-4, but that's pretty normal as well these days, I suppose. He defended well. His defence looked very, very good, and that's he batted longer. I think this might have been a slow S 100 actually. Batted for a long time, batted very well with a tail, as he does as well. He just looked very solid, very secure in a way he hasn't done he probably looked slightly more secure in his defence even than in that game, where because of the nature of the pitch in that Australia innings, he had to go for his shots a bit more. This looked sort of repeatable, like a guy who knows how to make hundreds, and he does know how to make hundreds. The tempo of that innings was brilliant, I think. He is very content to sort of just soak up a bit of pressure when a wicket falls or a bowler is in his spell, and then knows how to apply it the other end. There was one stretch when he got into the 90s, I think, with maybe 7 boundaries and 10 balls. He's very, very good at that, and it shows in his first class record. I mean, he's got pretty much the best first class record in that England setup, apart from Ollie Pope, I suppose. So that was hugely encouraging. Crawley and Root, I mean, it completely sort of predictable the Root would get that 100. I mean, it's not, I wouldn't say that's a huge tick in the box for Joe Root at number three quite yet. It's just nice.
Quite nice that he scored an undramatic test 100. Yes. All of his hundreds recently have been instant classics. Whereas this one was just quite nice. He batted very smoothly in the background. It was just such a pleasant partnership between Crawley and Root on that day.
Yeah, I was trying to think when Root would last have made hundreds with someone else being 100 in the same innings. It's
been a long time.
Yeah, but did Burns make one when he made that double in New Zealand?
Yes, he did.
And then
yes,
Cook at the end of that summer, I think is it 2018 summer, I think was the last one before that. So it's been a while since Root had that kind of support.
On Bairstow, I've definitely been guilty of forgetting how good Bairstow was in 2016, 2017. A lot has been made about how he's been messed about, and he has been messed about. He's batted everywhere between 3 and 7. The rest and rotation definitely didn't help him massively in Sri Lanka and India last year.
Gloves, there's no gloves as well. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. But I think very fundamentally, he has shored up a glaring weakness in his game, and it'd be really interesting to hear what Butch says about it when he's next on the show. But I think moving to off stump has really helped Bairstow. You did a thing looking at where he's been standing over the course of his career, but I think he's still actually getting beaten through the gate between bat and pad. It's just where he's standing, those balls aren't hitting the stumps anymore.
Yeah, I mean,
and he's so good off his legs that, you know, he's kind of like, he's inviting the bowler to bowl to his legs, and he doesn't really mind that.
Well, that's one of the theories about the off-stump guard, is that it works really well for the very, very best in the world, because the key thing is that you just can't miss those balls on your pads, because if you do, you're really in trouble. And Bairstow, at his best, he is as good a ball striker. He's got a brilliant eye. So you can see how that makes sense. But there is just so much that goes into it, isn't it? Because, I mean, he was doing this last summer against India, but was clearly not quite in the same sort of relentless form. So he was kind of getting, like, dismissed between 28 and 30, like, 4 or 5 times, I think. So, actually, I think, in terms of his peak in 2016, that for me was actually why it was frustrating that England kept sort of, like, stringing him along, keeping him around, rather than sort of properly saying to him, go and properly sort yourself out and then come back and be that force again. Because I think if you look at the trade-off they made before the 2019 World Cup with making be the, you know, one of the best ODI bats in the world, if that came at the expense of a test game, kind of fair enough, they would probably have taken that. Exactly. And he was brilliant in that campaign. And then going into, you know, where test cricket maybe becomes more important after that again, I think they should have said, go and completely sort yourself out. But he's managed to do that now, like, even while he's been around the England setup. Could it have happened quicker if they'd sort of properly said, you need to just get better at this before we're going to recall you? Because it was such a weird thing, wasn't it, when they dropped him in 2019 for 2 tests against New Zealand, and then kind of kept him around because there was a bit of an injury doubt, but then he didn't play, and then said, yeah, he's worked really hard this game, it's recalling for South Africa, and he hadn't played a game of cricket in that time. It was a really, really odd situation. But
yeah. It's quite interesting. We'll get to Zach Crawley in just a second, but those are two guys who had a really difficult run in Test cricket, and I think England deserve quite a lot of credit for actually persisting them when others I definitely wouldn't at times. And England have clearly identified that Bairstow and Crawley are two of their best 6 batters, and I guess it's quite difficult right now to really know where a player is at when they're not in the side. Bairstow plays a lot of IPL cricket. He's one of the most sought after IPL players in the world, so he doesn't get to play a huge amount of county championship cricket. I mean, Joe Root famously said towards the end of the Ashes, when he was asked what would you change about county cricket, and he said, how long have you got? You know, county cricket is not potentially the best place in the world for someone like Zach Crawley to become a test batter, and Zach Crawley has had to do that in the test environment. And it's just, you know, if that doesn't work, that's so brutal, and it was brutal for Crawley in 2021. But England, I know this is only one test match, but I think they deserve credit for sticking with these two guys, for identifying that these are two of their best 6 batters. They could easily have gone elsewhere in the last 12 months, but they didn't, and I think they deserve credit for that.
Yeah, you're right, and it's tempting to say, well, you know, they had to stick with them because they don't have any other options, but they do have other options still. Like, for that Ashes tour, they did not have to pick Crawley, who was in the midst of what still ended up as a record bad year for a top 6 batter. Like, they could have just gone back to Sibley, which is something that I felt would have been the right thing at the time, and had sort of a block out top 3 of Sibley, Burns and Hamid or something, or two of those opening. And again, with Bairstow, like, they could easily have said, look, okay, we've tried it. It's been a long time since you've scored more than 60. Like, let's put you aside. That, like, they actually could have done that. It'd be easy to say that, you know, like, I guess it's made easier to go back to them because no one else has come in and properly nailed it. But like, they deserve credit for it being those guys they've gone back to rather than perhaps some other guys.
Yeah. On Crawley, by the way, I was so impressed by his 100. I know that the pitch was pretty flat. I know that West Indies didn't bowl as well as we perhaps expected them to. Mm-hmm. But early on in the innings, he was a little bit indecisive outside off stump, and that's always been his weakness really as a Test cricketer. He times the ball as well as anyone. He always looks amazing, however short his stay at the crease is. But he's not been that decisive outside off stump. And when he got to about 15, you could sense like a clarity of thought was there. You could sense that he was batting within himself. He kind of parked the drive a little bit. West Indies tried to bowl to his pads and he was brutal. Anything direct to his pads, he was brilliant. And I guess showing that judgment, that's the question with Crawley. There's never been a question about, can he face high quality fast bowling? Is it going to be too good for him? There's never really been a doubt for that. Like that South Africa series in early 2020, he just came in the team, averaging 30 in first class cricket, not much of a record behind him. And he looked all right against Rabada and Orchid. That's not really been a doubt. The questions have been outside off stump. In the summer of 2021, when he was really, really struggling, it was kind of indecision outside off stump that was really his downfall.
And I mean, that first innings was a horror shot, really.
But that was exactly the kind of shot that he got out to in the middle of 2021. Yeah. It reminded me of he played a very similar shot last summer, and I think it might have been the Test match that he got dropped after. And yeah, he batted with real patience, and it actually kind of like Bairstow in that his eye is so good, he times the ball so well. When the bowling is bad, he will punish it, and he will always score at a reasonable rate, even when he's being more cautious. Yeah, I kind of wonder with Crawley that he's clearly such a good strike of a cricket ball. I kind of wonder if like opening is actually his best position. Like, I wonder if he never played for England in that first winter where he was a reserve and there were injuries that meant that he debuted at Hamilton and then Burns got injured in South Africa, then he had to open the batting in that series. I kind of wonder, because he made his debut as a six, I wonder if he didn't play that winter and he scores runs for Kent the following summer, if he ends up getting in the England setup as a middle order batter. I don't know.
I suppose what we're not really sure about yet with him, well, I mean, there are still a few things we're not sure about, I think. I mean, we're still not sure about how he deals with like sideways movements, like seam movement from fast bowling. We know he can play the real quick stuff, and we know he can make big hundreds. Now we know he can make other test hundreds as well. So there are some boxes ticked, but we also know how good he's against spin really at this point. Like it took him quite a long time after, so he was struggling that tour of India, took him quite a long time after that to face a ball of spin even in that summer, just because of how early he was getting out. And so I think that's why I think three might end up being his best position, but it will just depend on which other players England have available in form, whether he actually gets to settle in there at any point in the future, if he does stay opening or pop up and down a bit as the situations require, I suppose.
Nice to see Ben Folkes back in the England team.
Yes, yeah, and that was an important innings in that first innings, because England was still not in a dominant position when Stokes got out. I mean, they'd recovered a bit, but that took them up to sort of a parity on that opening day, that innings. And he, I mean, again, on that last, and it's probably been overplayed, his struggles against short pitch bowling, whatever, when it was what, two tests that you've got in that West Indies series last time out. But this wasn't the quickest pitch, so I suppose some people might still think that is a bit unanswered. But this was a very, very measured, composed, sort of wicket-keeperish test knock, I suppose. And he wasn't exactly completely flawless with the gloves, but you also saw the fact that he was able to stand up to Chris Wokes and take one mile down the leg side, which I suppose we'll get to Wokes' radar in a bit. But that is also just something that he adds, which is very nice. Because we were discussing sort of before the test, like how long it would be until sort of a Bairstow and the gloves debate comes back up again. And that, I mean, that'll settle it for this series, at least, I think, folks, in that first test. And then I guess when a new coach comes in, sort of all bets are off for a lot of things.
Exactly. Yeah. I was working on the third day when England only took five wickets and West Indies scored at less than two and over the entire day. That's one of the least exciting days of cricket that I've watched in a long time. Not that it wasn't interesting, Bonner scored 100 on that day, but I thought that day kind of exemplified what I thought was a trend over the whole 5 days from an English point of view, that it was a pretty good test without being spectacular for fringe players in earning Root's trust. So I thought with Wood down, Overton bowled pretty well. You know, he wasn't great with the new ball at the start of the West Indies first innings, but I thought he stuck to the plans that Root had clearly devised for him. When Wood was off injured, Stokes was tired, Overton ended up bowling like the bumper barrage at 78 miles per hour, which, you know, not the most thrilling sight in the world. It's not quite what people imagine Test cricket to be, but he did a job. And then Leach as well, kind of going at less than two and over, I thought was quietly important after the winter he had. And then obviously on day five, he took a few wickets and kind of gave England a sniff, but not a huge amount more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a good test for Leach, for sure. But I think if we're talking about the bowling, that opening spell on day two was pretty poor, I think. Like but what was interesting as well is that obviously without Broad and Anderson, there's obviously going to be so much focus on that passage of play, and it couldn't have gone much worse for England, really. I mean, West Indies, their opening struggles have been worse than England's over the last few years, and this was how long had it been since they'd made as many in an opening stand? It was coming at a decent rate, and this is Craig Brathwaite was, you know, smashing him around
since
the park.
Since they last played England in the West Indies,
right?
And okay, it's also the longest they've batted in a home test since England last toured as well.
Okay, so we bring the best out in them. But it was also interesting because the issue was really that they were bowling too... the lines were off as well, but they were just bowling quite full, which is obviously what Root wanted in the Ashes and was quite critical of his bowls of doing. And now in the first test without Broad and Anderson after it, that's what's happened. And it's not really worked. And then they bowled dry the next day and sort of got wickets through the day. And in the end, West Indies lead, which, you know, if they'd kept going at that rate, you know, would have been massive. But even if they'd gone at three and over, they would have been up by, what, like 450 at the end of that day or at the end of their innings. And as it was, there was enough time for England to build a lead and have a bit of a victory push. So
Wokes' radar was just off, though. Like, yes, he would bowl some really good balls, but they weren't consistent in where those good balls were pitched, if that makes sense. I mean, we got an interesting question from Tim. If England had all their options available, who would your ideal first choice pick be at number eight in away conditions? Our options, from an English point of view, seem less than ideal. Wokes now has the highest bowling average for an England seamer away from home who's bowled more than 300 overs. That's a pretty big sample size, and this is not my original point, but someone I play cricket with made the point on a WhatsApp group that, first of all, the age gap between Wokes and Broad isn't that big, and when Broad was Wokes' age, rightly or wrongly, England were then talking about future planning then, when Broad was a great with 400 test wickets behind him.
Yeah.
Wokes is somebody who's played a lot of cricket overseas, not done that well, recently hasn't done that well overseas, and 33. And I also thought it was a little bit down on pace as well. Like, actually, you could arguably say that his pace drop-off compared to where he was a couple of years ago is more stark than drop in pace in Anderson and Broad, which is arguably not noticeable at all.
Yeah, I think one of the issues England have had almost in general in Test cricket is the gap between things that should make sense in theory and things that don't actually work in practice. Like with our discussion with Bairstow, right? All the stuff we said, his defence looks solid, he can play spin and he can play pace, he can construct innings really well. All that stuff is arguments for Bairstow moving up the order. But we've seen when Bairstow bats in the top five in Test cricket, he has the third worst record of any England batter, I think, behind Radbrakash and Brearley for 50 innings, I think, is the cutoff. So he shouldn't do that, but there is an argument that he should do that. Same with Root at three, you know, most technically secure batter. He's coming in early anyway when he's at number four. And he's doing it now, and maybe it will go fine because there is always the theory there. But there's also that quite big sample size of evidence that he is quite a bit worse at three than at four. And then you get someone like Wokes who, you know, he's got that lovely repeatable action, can get up to reasonably high pace. He's got a brilliant white ball record, so you think he can be pretty accurate. And we know what he can do with the Duke's ball. Here he had a Duke's ball, he had the new ball, and that should just be like bread and butter to Wokes. He should be really like dominating the game from that point onwards. And he was really, really quite poor. And I guess how much longer do England think, like, well, we think there is an all-conditions test bowler in here when there is so much evidence that points against it.
Why does he struggle overseas? As you say, he has a Duke's ball here. You sometimes get slow wickets in England. His record in England is so good. What is it?
So, CricWiz's Ben Jones pointed out something that he's not as accurate as you might sometimes think he is. Like, I think, firstly, I think in England, because of sometimes how sizable the movement can be, you probably have a bigger area that you can actually pitch the ball in and bring a defensive striker relief, because there is that much more uncertainty going on. And he does bowl some absolute beauties in England, so that can kind of explain his good England record, I think. And then, like, because Anderson has become brilliant away from home by just
impeccable control,
exactly, being completely ungettable. Like in the Ashes, his strike rate was not good, but his wasn't brilliant, but his average was, because he was just so hard to get away. And Wokes just doesn't have that in him yet. And at this point, you wonder, because overall, his kind of rate in Test cricket is like above three and over, whereas that's quite a lot higher than both Broad's and Anderson's. Mm. And that, like, you have an economy of above three and over, because sometimes you go at three and a half, four. And I don't think, unless you're a proper strike bowler, you want your one of your quicks to be doing that regularly in away conditions, basically. So
it's quite interesting. I can see him actually doing quite well in this series. Like, that is not how Wokes normally bowls. There are periods in the Ashes where I thought were more clear reasons and examples of Wokes struggling overseas, where he was actually bowling okay, but for whatever reason wasn't really... on those wickets, wasn't really testing bats. He just wasn't quite enough of anything to really challenge batters. Whereas this was, he actually just bowled badly. And I think with a Duke's ball against a West Indies side that isn't great, you know, they're ranked eighth or ninth in the world. You know, they're in quite a long way in terms of ranking points behind where even England are at the moment. Mm-hmm. I can see him doing quite well if conditions are slightly better. If you have a slightly quicker pitch, I can see him doing well. But I do think at 33, him having a test that bad, what are England learning from Chris Wokes playing in overseas test matches? Aren't you better off, when we'll get to the makeup of the attack for the next test match, but if Robinson's fit, aren't you better off giving another test to Craig Overton to really see if he could be a viable option overseas in the years to come?
Well, I guess the two things is, one thing we should say with Wokes is that he has had a very long winter, as long as any of them have had, really, in terms of having played T20 World Cup and then Ashes and then coming out here. That is a lot of cricket to be playing, and he plays all formats all the time. Like, and because he's such like a sort of a, because often he's in squads and not playing, and because he's such a nice, amenable bloke, you can forget that he is like working as hard as any of the others in terms of his pure workload. The other thing as well, I guess, in terms of what the upside is, if England do think that this is a guy who is kind of close to cracking it and the ingredients are there, you can see that if it does click, he is a more attractive proposition for lots of reasons than say a Craig Overton.
He's batting quite well at the moment for a start.
Yeah, so I guess there is an upside there, but it's just been a long time since England have kind of seen that, I suppose, especially away from home.
The injury to Mark Wood was quite big. I think it had quite a big impact on the Test match as well. He is almost certainly out of the second Test match, injured out for the third Test match. As a result, Ben Stokes, who himself was an injury doubt with the ball, ended up bowling the most overs he'd bowled in an innings in something like 6 years in the first innings. I thought Stokes bowled brilliantly, by the way. I think it was really good to see a ball like that off the Ashes. So if Robinson is fit for the next Test match, how would you go about balancing that England attack?
Well, just on Stokes, just quickly, I think obviously he is going to bowl more when a bowler goes out injured and when a couple of your guys are, or well, when Wokes having an off day. That kind of makes sense.
Bowl Dan Lawrence more.
Yeah. And in that last innings, I mean, he was really being bowled into the ground there, and his pace was way down. England were like so far from really being able to win the game. I mean, fair enough to keep bowling just in case something weird happens. I mean, that can always happen. We saw some of the shots that West Indies played in that final day. But just have your spinners do it. And if it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. I guess we're going to come more to the England's approach in the final day a bit later. So for that attack, I think it is interesting because it just depends. It depends a lot on the pitch, which we haven't seen much of so far, so, and don't have much heard much of what it's going to be. It can be quite a quick one. But England need to think about what they want, what roles they want all the bowlers in their attack to fill, which actually sometimes you've seen Wokes, especially away from home. If he plays in a three with Broad and Anderson, it's
not
like,
that clear what his role in that team is.
Exactly.
And new ball.
I can see that being the case if England go in with Wokes, Overton, Robinson, which I still think is probably the most likely thing they will do. But I think that then you do have, you don't have a point of difference bowler there, and you don't have a guy who is going to come on and sort of really cause some trouble when there's a partnership building sort of thing. So that's an argument for playing, possibly. Saqib Ahmed, or possibly even Matt Parkinson. I mean, it really will depend on what the pitch is like. But in terms of a guy,
Parkinson, Claxton.
Yeah, well, yeah. But I mean,
we've flown out just for the off chance we might see Matt Parkinson's debut in the flesh.
Yeah. But in terms of a guy to break a partnership, and also, I don't know, presumably if Stokes wasn't that fit to bowl before the last test and has now bowled lows in this game, he's not going to be that fit to bowl for this game. I mean, you never know. But that might make sense then to have two spinners possibly rather than three seamers and a spinner, because that gives you that bit more flexibility in terms of guys who can bowl really long spells. And Parkinson can do that. He can bowl really long spells as well.
It's not as if, I think people kind of assume that leg spinners go for lows, and Parkinson doesn't actually.
It's better than Nietzsche first class cricket, yeah.
Yeah, and I think on the pitches like that, I think England just do need a point of difference bowler. Like, actually, in a strange way, Parkinson might be the closest like for like replacement to Mark Wood in terms of what he actually does and what difference he can bring on a pitch like that.
The slowest bowler in international cricket, yeah, but maybe the fastest. Yeah,
so. I think that could be quite interesting. An attack of Wokes, Overton, Robinson, if the pitch is anything like it was in Antigua, I think that is not giving yourself the best chance of taking 20 wickets there. It's not challenging batters in more interesting ways.
No, but I guess also, I mean, but we should mention Bonner a bit more, because he batted really, really well. But there is, more than with Australia and Australia, you do get the sense that maybe you can bore this West Indies side out. I mean, you saw that in the final day when they were playing for a draw and yet still lost two wickets to pretty bad strokes with Campbell hitting Leach to mid-on and Blackwood aiming a pretty wild slog. So actually, if England do have, and that is, I mean, if Wokes can sort of sort his radar out, that is an attack that can really bowl dry. And Robinson is very skillful as well. I think he would have been interesting to see bowl on that Antigua pitch.
And he had a reputation that was being built even before his Test debut as a bowler who can get good batters out on flat decks. And, you know, he actually, fitness issues aside, bowled well in Australia. Like, he held his own in pretty difficult circumstances and was really good in England last summer. And sometimes the pitches in England last summer were pretty good for batting. Actually, good of you to mention Bonner. I just want to run through his story quickly, just in case people don't know it. So he made his T20I debut against England a decade ago, played one game, then played another game the year after that against Australia. Then not seen in international cricket at all for 9 years until his Test debut in 2021. He averaged something like 24 in first class cricket until about 2018, 2019. He then averages 58 in first class cricket over one season. He's the fourth highest run scorer the season before COVID. Goes to England as a reserve batter, then gets his first opportunity on the Bangladesh tour last year, where lots of first team players pulled out of the tour, and has done pretty well since. He scored 100 against Sri Lanka also at Antigua last year, and he's got a few good scores against Bangladesh as well.
Yeah, well, that Bangladesh series, because that was a kind of an amazing win for West Indies, actually, with all his players out, and Bangladesh are strong at home. And obviously, Kyle Mayers was the debut that caught the eye with a double 100 in the fourth innings. It's going to do that. But Bonner played a really
important knock in that game.
Yeah, and I think the guys in the Caribbean Cricket Podcast, who obviously know their stuff, they were kind of saying after that they actually expected Bonner to have the longer and then more successful Test career at that point, which I think you can see.
I'll be interested to see how it goes on quicker pitches, because what really stood out on that third day was just how much patience he had.
Mm.
England were bowling pretty well. They stuck to their plans. Paul Collingwood came out after the game and was very pleased with how England bowled that day. Butch on BT Sport again was very positive about how England bowled on that day. England bowled well. They didn't give West Indies many opportunities scoring runs, and Bonner was like, I'm fine not taking risks. I'm fine going at less than 2 and over, which is quite interesting. I wanted to ask you what you made of Carlos Brathwaite's comments on BT Sport. Friend of the show, Carlos Brathwaite, of course. He said, if I were Craig Brathwaite or any of the senior players in the West Indies dressing room, I would have found it a bit disrespectful that in the last hour of the test, with two set batters playing as they were and the pitch offering nothing, England still felt they could get 6 wickets going all the way down to 5 balls left. Would England have done this if this were an Ashes test match? Would they have done it against India? Would they have done it against New Zealand or Pakistan? He's basically saying, why didn't England shake hands with half an hour to go, an hour to go? I think it's interesting that he says that. I'd say flip side. I wonder if England are influenced. Personally, I think if you can win the game, you should play. I don't understand why you'd shake hands. Bowl the spinners. You don't need to risk Stokes, but if there's a chance to win a test match, play on. England in 2020 shook hands with an hour to go against Pakistan when they needed six wickets from the final hour, and that was when they could have qualified for the World Test Championship. They can't do that now, but still, I want teams to play until they can't win anymore. Isn't that what people want to see?
Yeah, that Pakistan Test is much more looking back, because in 2019, I think in the Lord's Test, so before the Headingley game, England, they need four Australia wickets by the end of that game, and they kept bowling until there were three balls left in that final over again. I mean, it's in some ways you can ask, why are they stopping when there are only five balls left? Because, you know, you can get stumpings off wides, you can get run outs off no balls. Six wickets and six balls is already very unlikely. I think maybe where he's coming from and why, because it wasn't just that England kept going. They were kind of playing as if they really felt that they had a chance, or that it felt really important that they get the win there. And I think it more spoke to England's desperation for a win, having won, only one in 15 now. And also, I think there are just quite a lot of people out there who are quite keen for some sort of statement result, basically. Because it wasn't just Joe Root or the guys in the field. There was a moment, I think, when the ball went for four and Jeetan Patel was right there on the other side, picking it up, throwing it back in so they could sort of get the overs in that last hour. And obviously, you know, Paul Collingwood has said he'd be interested in the England head coach job. There are other coaching roles that are going to be available. If they had just been bowling the spinners, I would have no issue with it whatsoever. But the other thing that's different to the Pakistan Test, and which makes both of them odd, I think, is that there's not just a game to win here, there's a series to win. And it's, you know, there's only 3 days between each of the three test matches. So actually, putting that workload on your bowlers could really come back to hurt you. And I mean, you know, in which perspective, you've already got one down in Mark Wood and you're already a bit of experience short. That was the thing that I thought was a bit odd. But no, I mean, fine with them trying to win a game of cricket. I mean, it's so rare that they get the chance to. Mm. So.
Next up, we'll hear from Taha, who is in Rawalpindi for Pakistan's first home test against Australia in 24 years. It was a bit of a run fest, but it was a great occasion, worth celebrating nevertheless.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
I'm talking to Wisden star Hashim, who's speaking to me from Rawalpindi, just minutes after the culmination of the first test between Pakistan and Australia. Taha, before we get onto the pitch and the cricket, I want to get a sense of what the atmosphere's been like in Rawalpindi. Australia, just the fourth side to tour Pakistan for a test series since international cricket's return to the country, and it's the first time Australia have played a test there in 24 years. How have the Pakistani public received Australia?
Yeah. You can't escape the occasion of it all. Even after 5 days of watching that, and we'll get to that. It took me till the end of the third day to realise that this was not a very good test match. And that was because the first 3 days, I was still kind of lost in what I'd kind of taken in, and what I've been taking in for the last few days, really. The crowd here has been immense, really. We're day five, it's a dead day. There's still empty seats, but there's few empty seats. I don't think we'd get this kind of sense of atmosphere, in other countries. It was peculiar kind of watching it today, because the crowd was still filtering through, and obviously they recognised that they were going to see Abdul Shafiq score 100. They recognised they were going to see Imam Al-Haq score 100, and that means something. Just to give you an example, I went and sat in the crowd for a bit today, and I spoke to a dad who brought his 16-year-old son along. His 16-year-old son is decked in a Pakistan shirt, had sort of encyclopedic knowledge, loves Pat Cummins, wants to go play cricket one day. And so this day still meant a lot to him, this day meant a lot to his dad. So, you know, that's just one story, but I'm sure there are stories like that across the ground today, because this is still a significant occasion. 24 years, it's a number that's been going around all week. You keep hearing it. There's a lot of appreciation for Australia coming here, but not just them coming here, it's the full strength team coming here. I think that means a lot, because they're seeing the best players in the world. They're seeing Smith, they're seeing Hazelwood, they're seeing Cummins. And so it's still very hard to get out of that occasion. I think now we will move away from that. We'll talk about how terrible that pitch was. And hopefully we'll have more of a contest in the next two tests where we can actually talk about the cricket, which is what everyone does want to get to eventually. You want to see a good contest. But yeah, there's still been something celebratory about what we've seen in the last 5 days that you can't escape.
Yeah, even just from the TV, it was notable how much the players from both sides really got into the atmosphere as well. Loads of videos of David Warner having fun with the fans, etc. I'm going to have to ask you about the pitch, I'm afraid. As much as we'd like to think otherwise, that was a horribly dead pitch. There were few, if any, really entertaining passages of play. A stat that Andy Zaltzman tweeted at the end of the game: in the context of the dullest tests ever played, the overall match strike rate for the bowlers for both teams was 175, which is the 11th highest of 1,727 tests in which at least 300 overs have been bowled. I'm going to read out the criteria for what the ICC deem a poor wicket. A poor pitch is one that does not allow an even contest between bat and ball, either by favouring the batters too much and not giving the bowlers from either team sufficient opportunity to take wickets. They give the example of this being a pitch that displays little or no seam movement or turn at any stage in the match, with no significant bounce or carry, thereby depriving the bowlers of a fair contest between bat and ball. They very rarely give out poor ratings, but it wouldn't be unfair if this pitch was given it 14 wickets over 5 days. I know there's a little bit of rain. A couple of times went off of bad light, but there was very few times where the bowlers looked like they were in the contest at all.
Yeah, it just refused to break up. There was a point in the first day where the footmarks were appearing. Quickly recognised that the spin was the way to go over pace. Australia just picked one spinner. And you thought, oh, Pakistan have called it right here by picking two spinners. Two spinners and Iftikhar's at number seven to bowl a bit of off-spin. But the more you thought about it, the more, yes, Australia probably should have picked on the spin, but it wouldn't have made a difference. Mitchell Swepson, a young talented bowler, he wouldn't have somehow dramatically ripped through that Pakistan lineup, because whoever you picked, you're going to have a tough time on that pitch. It didn't offer anything. It didn't offer any jeopardy. It's weird how we talk about bad pitches. Let's go back to a year ago when we were talking about the India-England series, and there was all that chat about, the excessive turn. That still offers a bit of excitement. It still offers a sense of jeopardy. This was obviously the complete opposite, and this for me was the kind of worst type of a bad pitch, really, isn't it?
Do you think the Australia bowlers are escaping a little bit of criticism because they only took three wickets? I mean, the fourth wicket was a run out across 239 overs. Pakistan did at least bowl Australia out, and in the second innings, I know they turned away from their seamers completely fairly early on in the contest, but that's a long time to only get four wickets.
Look. It's very obvious that Pakistan aren't bowled Australia. But then again, also take into account, Australia haven't really warmed up. So this test basically turned into a warm-up match for them. They don't know these conditions like the Pakistanis do, obviously. So you kind of have to almost give them this test match off. I don't like doing that. I feel like a test match should be given more importance. But the matter of fact is they haven't done a warm-up game. So this basically becomes their warm-up. And, you know, Pakistan, yeah, you're right. I mean, like, if you look at Noman Ali, he realised the pitch wasn't doing it. And then we found that those footmarks outside leg stump, and he attacked that through there and grabbed a couple of wickets. And that was a smart piece of bowling, really. That fifth day where, you know, I think Pat Cummins bowled four overs, something like that. This immediate realisation. But, you know, there's no point, you know, putting myself through this. No point putting our quicks through this when there's just 3 days between the first and second test matches. Yeah, weird final day.
Some people, not many, argue that Pakistan could have shown a little bit more intent with the bat in that first innings. If they did score 600 rather than 470, that is a different game. Do you buy that at all?
The thing is, it was such a slow pitch that, look, yes, it was kind of easy to bat on. I wouldn't say it was necessarily easy to score on. I thought the most enthralling passage of play was the start of day three when Khawaja and Warner are batting and they went for their shots. But they also had the new ball and they had the pace of Shaheen and Nasim, who were really going for it and, you know, testing them with the short ball and stuff. And so that was when you could really score. But it was, you know, look at someone like Steve Smith. It's all about, you know, Smith may not be the level he was 2 years ago. But even he was getting runs, but wasn't. You never really looked at any, you know, you never really looked at him as being free flowing. It was tough to that criticism of not showing enough intent. It's tough to really. I'm not totally convinced by it, to be honest.
Yeah, when there's so little pace in the pitch, it is difficult.
Yeah, it looked like it was still hard to score quickly. Basically, you could get your runs, but you still have to take your time and do it, yeah.
Mm. I was saying to you earlier that I think me and you have been a bit spoiled in recent times by watching England. England are entertaining for predominantly the wrong reasons, but the right ones as well. And I also think it is actually worth saying that the batsmanship to make it look that easy is something that we can take for granted a little bit. I think both teams obviously batted very well in those conditions. One thing that's quite interesting about this series is that there are two teams that are quite hard to work out where they are at the minute. Australia are ranked number one in the world, but they haven't played an away test in nearly 3 years. And this Pakistan side has actually changed a lot in recent times. I mean, we were talking the other day that really only Azhar Ali in this side you'd really associate with that UAE era of Pakistan cricket. The turnover has actually been pretty quick. So which players from a Pakistan point of view stood out for you?
It'd be very hard for me not to say Imam Ul Haq scoring two centuries. Look, the second one, obviously, you know, a lot of part-time bowling, so you have to take that into consideration. But the first day, it's hard not to be really impressed by that. Obviously, we didn't totally grasp just how much of a road it was on the first day. But look, he's making his first test appearance since 2019, and he's still up against Stark, Cummins, Hazelwood. Take into account, forget the conditions and focus on test cricket as a mental game, that's still a battle to overcome. You might still get one that you switch off from and you're out. It wasn't impossible to get out for a low score in the test. Travis Head got out for 8. My thoughts are with him. Imam Hook focused, he played really nicely. He kind of was patient to begin with against pace, recognised opportunities against spin when Travis Head came on, you know, moved, used his feet against line. It was still a very well-constructed innings. So he really impressed me. I'm going to speak. 6th first-class game, 3rd 100, first test 100. Don't know much about him, but I think we'll be seeing a lot more of him. Granted, that first test century has come against a lot of part-time spin bowling, but you still got to put the balls away. And he did that. And he's obviously got a record. He's probably got a stupid average right now. I haven't looked at it. But he's obviously a pretty decent player. And so I think we're going to see a lot more of him.
He's quite an interesting... Just on him. He's quite an interesting story because, as you're right in saying, he's only played 3 first-class games that are not test matches. And his domestic side is the same one that Babrizan plays for. And in 2019-20... that their side had at least 5 players who played test cricket for Pakistan. So it's a hard side to get into. He gets in there, and I think he scores 100 on debut. And, you know, he's got a lot of teammates that are good people to impress. He gets parachuted straight into a Pakistan squad, but there's no first-class cricket in Pakistan for a year. So just as you'd expect him to take the next step in his development and hopefully score more runs in domestic cricket, he didn't actually get that opportunity. And Pakistan made the quite brave call to just take him on their tours to, I think he was reserved to England and he was reserved in New Zealand. They gave him a few T20s and then Here he is now, three tests into his career, and he's passed 50 in 5 of his 8 first class innings, and he's turned 3 of those into 100. So, even just aesthetically, I thought it was really impressive, very pleasing on the eye, and he just looks very composed in defence. He's got a very Babar-esque kind of just nudge into the leg side that's very calm. Seems to have a lot of time, but I guess everyone had a lot of time on that pitch. And who do you think will be the happier side after this test match? Or do you just think that because of how far away it was to getting a result, it's actually hard to say?
It's still Pakistan, surely, I think. Two openers who didn't come into this match with any centuries have left it with 3 between them. Hazar Ali's got runs. Babar was looking good until he got run out. And their bowlers, like Shaheen bowled really well as well, I thought, for what he could do on that pitch. Pakistan will still be, I think they'll definitely take this. They'll be the happiest. Right? Look, Australia took 4 wickets, of course. I know this is bad, but 4 wickets. So, yeah. And also, going for them that no one got a century on this pitch, definitely. That would have been a huge confidence boost. You know, Kawhi 3 runs away. Labuschagne, still yet score a test century away from home. That would have been just something to get off the back, but it's still there. So Pakistan, yeah, definitely the happiest side.
Nice one. Good to speak to you, Tar, and I'll speak to you again after the next test. See you then. Frogbox is the all-in-one streaming kit that makes broadcasting live cricket accessible for clubs, schools and associations in the UK. Designed for recreational cricket, the Frogbox solution is the innovative, lightweight and low-cost product designed for volunteer-operated clubs. Integrated with the Play Cricket Scorer app, all you need to do on match day is set up the portable video capture kit and live score the match on the app. Their automation technology will take care of the rest. Stream to YouTube with high-quality graphics, generate highlights of your greatest moments and connect with your community like never before. Frogbox professionally showcases cricket at any level while offering new revenue opportunities for amateur cricket clubs. The automated graphic packages have multiple displays and advertising opportunities available, engaging the end user and delivering high-quality visibility for your corporate partners. Ben, the Women's World Cup has been brilliant so far. At the time of recording, England are about to play their third game. They're in a bit of trouble. They've lost 2 out of 2. Second one, a bit of a surprise defeat to West Indies. I mean, definitely a surprise defeat to West Indies. They're very sloppy in the field. Sort of such a shame because Sophie Ecclestone bowled amazing. I was watching that live at the time. I think she bowled an over where England took 3 wickets without conceding a run. She finished with, I think it was a 3 for 20 off 10. But England weren't that ruthless in the field or with the ball, Ecclestone apart. Shemaine Campbell, 66, helped West Indies put on a competitive score, one that ended up defending. And to be honest, even though the England wobbled earlier in the run chase, it looked like Cross and Ecclestone would take them home. But West Indies managed to cling on. And yeah, it's not looking very good for England at the moment.
No, I guess it's maybe slight parallels to the 2017 World Cup when they obviously lost that opener to India and then won everything else from there on in. But I think the other thing as well this time is that the schedule kind of works against them. I mean, we might be proven very silly because they're about to play South Africa right now, but their last 2 games are against Pakistan and Bangladesh, and they could easily be out by then. Whereas last time, I think they, after they lost the game to India, they then had Pakistan next and sort of got themselves back into form. I think Knight and Siv both scored hundreds in that game. And then from there on, they were kind of into the tournament. Whereas England are going to have to, they kind of need to win this one, really. I mean, they might just be able to get away with losing one more, possibly. And if they win all the rest, they will definitely be in the semis. But I've seen they dropped Lauren Winfield Hill, Danny White's, and opened the batting, which would be interesting.
Charlie Dean coming to the side. That's quite interesting because before the tournament, I thought going batting heavy would suit England. But actually, they were poor with the ball. Ecclestone apart in that game, they really did need other bowling options in that game, so I guess that makes sense. And Winfield Hill, as we talked about on the show before, has just been out of runs for such a long time. You're kind of like, you're not actually missing out on a huge amount of runs there if you leave her out.
And I think we have seen possibly in the past with England, and you've talked about the fact that they They actually haven't had, apart from Bowman, a properly standout battery from these ones who we think of as being properly established players. And I do sometimes...
Not in ODI cricket.
Yes, yeah. And I do sometimes wonder if the depth of the batting lineup can sometimes play into that. Like if you kind of, if you know you bat down to eight or whatever, that you don't need to take responsibility in quite the same way, which... is possibly a factor, but I don't know. But overall, it's just been a brilliant tournament, hasn't it? I mean, West Indies, I did say in the preview show that they would, I still don't think they'll make the semi-finals, but I did say that they would have a say, and they have done that, beating New Zealand as well in their opening game. And there have been so many close games, and even ones that you wouldn't have picked out as being like anywhere near close. I mean, South Africa being given a scare by Bangladesh, and Pakistan. They only beat Bangladesh by 32 runs. I mean, yeah, maybe not a scare, because I guess they were behind the rate a bit, but still, it was a decent game. And I guess you could say that they've looked slightly shaky with two easy games to start, and they've won them both, but they haven't looked hugely convincing. I mean, even the England Australia game was a really good game, even though England lost it, and in a way, they might have taken some confidence from that after
definitely.
A pretty poor Ashes series. So the West Indies will have been a real blow.
And then even like one of the games that wasn't close at all actually has quite interesting ramifications for the rest of the tournament. India demolishing West Indies, hundreds for Mandana, Harmanpreet. So not only are their gun batters finding form at the right time, but also West Indies, who have those two big wins under their belt, their net run rate is really, really bad now. They got two narrow wins and now one huge defeat. It's so bad at the moment in comparison to their opponents that they almost might need another win already over the teams vying for that fourth place.
Yeah, and I think it's been interesting as well. I mean, England obviously haven't had a good start, but I mean, it has been kind of as many predicted that Australia have been pretty dominant, but the rest have all been flawed. I mean, South Africa, the only other team yet to lose a game, but they've only they played the 2 week teams. Everyone else has kind of lost one. It does kind of feel like, especially in that top six, that anyone can kind of beat anyone, although Australia kind of are streaking away.
Yeah, I can't really confidently predict at all who's going to finish second, third and fourth. I wouldn't be surprised by any of them finishing second, third or fourth,
yeah,
really.
Yeah, I agree, yeah.
Which obviously makes for a really, really good tournament. Elsewhere, India have been playing Sri Lanka in a test series that's about to end at the time of recording. India are almost certainly going to win that 2-0 tomorrow. In the first test match, Pant scored an incredibly fun 96, where he went from 50 to 96 very, very quickly, just murdering the spinners. Jadeja scored 175, not out, and he took loads of wickets as well. He's now the number one ranked test all-round in the world. Anything you want to add from that first test match?
From the first test, I mean, Jadeja, I mean, it's just worth pointing out. I mean, we've said it before, but his all-round numbers are absolutely ridiculous. I think in that game, he was the first all-rounder to score 150 and then take 9 wickets in a game, just missed out on his 10-4. But that is an incredible feat. Not much to add beyond that. I mean, Rohit hasn't got a score, which is interesting. And Shreyas Iyer looks very good, although that's especially so in this game. But
yeah, and then just on that second game, I'll go to a question from a listener. Stu asks, can you rate the pitches that have been used in the last couple of weeks in Test cricket? So Antigua, Rawalpindi, Bangalore. He gave Antigua a 7 out of 10 and he gave the other two 4s out of 10. It has been quite interesting because that Rawalpindi pitch was it was eventually given a below average rating by the ICC. The Antigua pitch I actually think was slightly better than I thought at the time. I just think you basically had the perfect ingredients for really boring cricket at some points, in that Bonner was just fine going at 2 in the over. England without Wood didn't really have a point of difference bowler in the middle of the test match when you expect the pitch to be at its flattest. So I think 7 is probably a little bit high for me. It didn't break up as much as you want. 5 or 6, I don't think it was bad. Rawalpindi, I think was probably slightly worse, but not a huge amount. But I thought the Bangalore pitch, the one they're using for the second test match, the day-night test match between India and Sri Lanka, on day one, that was actively bad. I thought that is not good. Sometimes when we criticise pitches on this show, people think we're applying double standards by, you know, we like pitches that seem, but we don't like pitches that spin. But that's not what I'm saying at all. It's nothing to do with the spin that I think is bad about the Bangalore pitch. It's that the bounce was so inconsistent on day one. I mean, Kohli got done by one that shot couple of inches off the floor on day one. There are a few balls off the spinners on day one that were coming up at almost shoulder height. You don't want to see that on day one. And that test match has done well to go to a third day.
Yeah, I do agree with you. So I'm kind of just saying the counterpoint for the sake of it. But it has encouraged some very, very entertaining batting.
That's
again.
True, yeah.
So Rishabh Pant today hit India's fastest ever test 50. Which is fun. Shreyas Iyer on that first day hit 92 off 98, which again is very good, and he looks an absolutely brilliant player of spin bowling. And even, I mean, I guess this kind of goes in favour of your argument that Matthews made 43 and it was a brilliant innings, basically.
Yeah.
Sort of 43 of 85 was picking length absolutely brilliantly. And then also you look at it and, you know, I mean, I guess this might feed into the low bounce thing, but, you know, seven of India's wickets went to their quicks. I don't know if you saw the stat we put out on Mohammad Shami. He has the second best average in I think minimum 70 wickets, the second best average in Asia of any bowler ever, not pace or spin, behind Imran Khan, which is and Bumrah's first home fiver as well after many overseas.
He's just not played many tests at home, has he?
Yeah.
Ben, we've had some law changes. Do you want to talk us through the headline?
Well, I mean, I suppose the headline and the one that people most picked out was the moving of the Mankad section, the run out and non-striker's end.
Can you explain why this is important?
Well, yeah, and there's one misconception I want to clear up as well, because Stuart Broad actually, he said, oh, it's been moved from unfair play. I thought Mankads were always in the rules, and they have always been in the rules. It was actually the unfair play bit was the non-striker leaving the ground before the ball was bowled. I think this is an attempt to normalise it further. And in a way, it also normalises non-strikers leaving their ground before the ball is bowled, because now you can just be run out in the run-out section rather than run out in the unfair play section. So there's no sort of moral judgment cast on the non-striker, which is saying a risk that you have to take. I mean, we probably don't need to do the Mankad debate. Broad says that it takes zero skill, which is debatable, and also raises the question of what you do about any wicket taken off a long hop or a leg side strangle.
I guess he would possibly argue that someone had to catch it or whatever, but I gave the example of the Kate Cross run out in the England West Indies game, where someone drills it down the ground, the bowler dropped the ball onto the stumps, having no idea where Kate Cross was. No skill involved there.
Yeah, but and I suppose if you wanted to, you could also legislate those dismissals out of the game. You could say that a run out has to come from you could throw the word deliberate in there to attempt to get the ball onto the stumps or whatever, and that would remove accidental drops and other sort of deflections, which I know leave a sour taste in some people's mouths. So I mean, there is a consistent viewpoint to remove both Mankads and run outs at the non-striker's end in other ways, but I kind of think the situation is sort of fine as it is. Other rule changes, I mean, another one that again is sort of headlinable was the saliva, it being banned permanently and only using sweat. But I think a study by the MCC showed that actually wasn't making much of a difference at all to how much the ball was being
again swim, another so. Ben Jones quick viz stat, he said that since sweat's been used predominantly since the start of COVID, there's been no noticeable change in data of how much swing there has been. Mm-hmm. So doesn't really make a difference.
Yeah. But
although I'd love to know if that breakdown applies country by country, just because are people going to be sweating in early April as much as they might do here in Barbados?
That's true. maybe this is what will make batting in county cricket easy, finally. The fact that knowing bowlers are able to sweat. And then one which I actually think, well, there's two more actually. One is just the thing that's coming from the 100 of the when a batter is out court, the new batter always takes guard at the end that they come in and or that the batter on strike was at, which is such a common sense change that it's been fun seeing people who hate the 100 sort of say like, oh, this is ridiculous. No, this wasn't the reason why cricket was bad sort of thing. Why are they changing this thing? It doesn't need changing. And it's like, this is just a bit better, which what the MC do with their laws is try and make it a bit better. The one which I'm sort of maybe skeptical about if it will be a good thing or not, and I think could change Limitos batting, like, I mean, not hugely, but not considerably, is the change to the wide law. So before, you could almost have sort of like a cat and mouse game where a batter would say step outside leg stump and then step back in just as the ball is bowled, and if the bowler tries to bowl at where the batter was, they could sort of earn a wide that way. Whereas now, if as long as the ball passes at kind of where the batter was at any point during the run-up, it won't be a leg side wide.
So basically, if a batter backs away to leg and then moves back towards his stumps, previously if a ball was given, it was delivered, you know, a foot or two outside leg stump, that would be given a wide. Whereas now, if the batter has gone that far to the leg side, that would not be a wide.
Yeah. And also similarly, if they move across to the offside and then move back towards the leg side, you should theoretically be able to get away with bowling one outside the tram lines. Whether that actually comes into play will remain to be seen. But that will be interesting to see if that has an impact, I suppose.
Cool. Well, that is all we have time for on today's show. Cheers, Ben. We'll be back after the Barbados test, where we'll be joined by Butch.
Podcast Network.